Good evening and good morning, everyone. I'm Bridget.
And I'm Shelby, and we are your hosts for this installment of Coffee and Conversations.
Coffee and Conversations is a monthly interactive sit-down event hosted by CSOFT. Every month, we'll feature honorary guests and experts from a diverse range of industries and fields to lightly discuss topical themes important to the life sciences and language services industry. So sit down and relax, pour yourself a coffee, tea, or a hot drink, and enjoy.
Thanks, Bridget. This month, we are joined by our special guest, Professor Victoria Elegant, Vice President of the JPAC Regional Medical Head and Site Head of Amgen, to discuss the evolution of global medical affairs, as well as new innovation and the importance of patient voices within the space.
The pace of change within global medical affairs is remarkable. Technologies like telehealth and virtual clinical trials, to name a few, are revolutionizing how people connect across borders within the medical field. As a specialty, global medical affairs has had to adapt from where it first began, centered around drug development and R&D, to now driving the future of medicine and international collaboration.
You know, that's so true, Bridget. Global medical affairs really helps to disseminate information and drive the adoption of new technologies between the pharmaceutical companies and healthcare providers all around the globe, a really encouraging communication across borders and improving overall global health, something that we have all very much relied on over this past year. So now we can move forward with introducing our guests, Professor Elegant and Ms. Shuni Yi.
Professor Victoria Elegant is a physician who joined the pharmaceutical industry after postgraduate training in obstetrics and gynecology in the United Kingdom. She has held positions in global drug development, medical affairs, regulatory affairs, and drug safety in Japan, Australia, Europe, and Asia Pacific. Prior to Amgen, Professor Elegant was the Vice President, Regulatory and Medical Affairs, based in Shanghai in 10 years for Baxter, and Vice President, Medical Affairs Asia, based in Singapore for Shire. Professor Elegant is involved in the evolving role of medical affairs in being the bridge between R&D and commercial, and in partnerships with healthcare professionals and patient groups to improve patient outcomes and standards of care in the Asia Pacific region. Professor Elegant is president of the Asia Pacific chapter of the Medical Affairs Professional Society, or MAPS. She has also published extensively on regulatory affairs, medical affairs, clinical development in the Asia Pacific region. Born in Hong Kong, Professor Elegant's passion is improving standards of care and outcomes for patients in the Asia Pacific. Welcome, Professor Elegant. We're glad you can join us this evening.
Thanks, Bridget. So Ms. Shuni Yi is the president and CEO of CSOFT International and CSOFT Health Sciences, which provides end-to-end medical translation services for all phases of the product lifecycle, market access consulting, medical writing, and CTD, ECTD submissions with the FDA, EMA, and NMPA. Shuni is passionate about education and has contributed to Michelle Obama's Let Girls Learn initiative, the Hopkins Nanjing Center for Chinese and American Studies, and Dexter Southfield School. Welcome, Shuni. Thank you for joining us as well. So without further ado, Shuni and Professor Elegant, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Bridget and Shel. Good evening, Victoria. And thank you so much for joining us from Hong Kong today. The last time you and I were together, we were with Dr. King, Dr. Yaw, CJ, and Pat at the GBA virtual panel discussing cross-border challenges, opportunities during pandemic. That was almost 7-8 months ago, last November. Time flies, we carry on. And the world is still battling against one of the worst pandemics in human history. So my first question, how have you seen COVID-19 reshape our healthcare ecosystem and change the landscape of global medical affairs, particularly regarding engagements with the healthcare professionals? Can you first briefly introduce and describe evolution and development of global medical affairs and how it has responded to the challenges and opportunities during this challenging time?
Thanks, Shuni, and thanks, Bridget and Shelby, for the very kind introduction. It's always a pleasure to be here with you. We could spend about 4 hours talking all about that, to be perfectly honest. So I think maybe just setting the scene about COVID, there's an awful lot to say, but we all know how much COVID has actually changed the landscape, particularly healthcare, in the last, it's now 18 months, unbelievable. No, we started in Asia at the end of January, middle of January in China, or end of December 2020. So that's 18 months ago. It's extraordinary how long it's gone on for, but, you know, we adapt. I think one of the, several of the major impacts that COVID has had is one we've seen on the development of vaccines. Normally, vaccines take 10 years to develop, and we've seen that really the companies have adapted very quickly, the regulatory authorities have adapted very quickly, and we've actually compressed that timing to from 10 years to a year, basically. Nobody really thought it would be possible, but, you know, anything's possible. And there are some things that were done around the clinical trials that have helped that. I think how that's going to impact in the future is that for drugs that are really necessary, people won't accept these long development timelines anymore. And so as an industry, we will have to work really, really closely with the regulators for drugs that are really meeting huge unmet medical needs to figure out a way to really make the development time faster. So that's one area. I just mentioned the clinical trials. So clinical trials actually were quite, still are to a certain extent, quite cumbersome. But what we did was we found ways with the clinical trials to do remote, much more remote monitoring. It used to be it was all done by the by CRAs going out to the sites. We were moving that way anyway. But now most of the monitoring is done remotely and the regulatory agencies have approved that. We've found ways to deliver the drugs to the patients at home. It's never been particularly convenient, you know, to be honest. I think that patients are absolutely wonderful for taking part in clinical trials and being so selfless, because it requires a lot of sacrifice to actually participate in a clinical trial, give up your time, you know, accept the risks that are there, that kind of thing. But so we tried during COVID to really try and do things like do more around telehealth, for example, not just in trials, but also in delivery of healthcare. And I'll come back to that. And actually teletrials where the patients could stay where they were, and we figured out how to do the blood tests, you know, send people to do the blood tests, send them their medication, that kind of thing. So to make it more convenient for the patients. And we'll come back to the effect that COVID has had on patients as well. So those are some of the things I think that have impacted COVID. Then there's a whole, you know, the remote engagements. So we'll come back to that. I think the question that you asked me originally was, how has medical affairs evolved?
Right.
And it's a really good question. So initially, the medical affairs function was really a support function that provided some scientific guidance to the commercial organizations. And actually, to be honest, they did a lot of copy clearance. So they basically reviewed materials, they did medical information, so they answered questions from external healthcare providers, that kind of thing. So it was really a support function. Now, medical affairs has really evolved to be what we call the third pillar. So the pillar in between commercial and R&D. And the reason for that is that medical affairs and the staff and teams in medical affairs are really the ones who engage externally with all our external healthcare provider stakeholders. And so medical affairs is now included right at the beginning of development to make sure that we actually get the insights from our healthcare providers to make sure that the compounds we develop are meeting the needs, meeting unmet medical needs, that we get continuous feedback from our external stakeholders to make sure that we do that right. And also that the strategies that we employ as medical and as the commercial teams are the right ones to make sure that we get the right drugs to the right patients at the right time once they've been developed. Another big area is education. So medical, so the medical teams, right? Sales teams have sales targets, right? So they're bonused and they're targeted on their sales, which is right. That's their job. The medical teams, their job is to engage externally, to provide the scientific information, and to make sure that we provide increasingly education to our stakeholders. So, for example, as compounds get more and more complex, if you think about oncology, my mother died of colorectal cancer, and she died about 20 years ago. And at that time, the treatment options were very limited. If she'd lived another 20 years and got it now, there's all these targeted therapies based on mutations. So actually, the treatment options are huge. It makes it really, really complicated. I was talking to somebody yesterday who said to me, have you seen the report, the genomic report that comes back when you order tests on breast cancer biopsy? It's like 8 pages long because of all the different tests that you can do to make sure that the patient actually gets the right targeted therapy. So as those things become more complicated, it's medical's job to make sure that the physicians and other healthcare providers have the education in order to get the latest updates in the therapeutic area, and also that they know how to use these increasingly complex drugs. And then the other piece that's coming to more and more of the forefront is really the patient voice, engaging with patient organizations to make sure that the patients have a voice, that we educate the patients, those sorts of things. So that's really been the evolution of medical affairs. And I believe very firmly that medical will continue to evolve in that same direction and will become increasingly important in making sure, as I said, we have the right drugs to meet the right needs and that they get to the right patients in the right way.
Yeah. So, Victoria, this is very interesting. There are particularly two things you mentioned about. One is, you know, post-pandemic, let's say, you know, the pandemic sets a different expectation for patients. Patients, you know, not going to want to wait 10 years for the drug, right? So that was, seems like a driving force, right, for some of the innovation coming from the patient. The other side is very interesting. You talk about the education. So it seems like not just the internally for professional get educated, but look like externally, you know, healthcare givers and, mm-hmm. And then patient themselves, you know, when you're facing a variety of different the options. Right. So this is a kind of an interesting kind of a lead to me. My second question, in your recent paper, Reimagining Scientific Engagement During COVID-19, published on the Medical Affairs Professional Society, you talked about, you discussed developing strategies, the solutions, a change management plan drive a new business norm. Clearly, there's a shift, right? Like you mentioned about more telehealth, more decentralized clinical trials, because I want you to tell us, our audience, how this impacted your work and business in a daily kind of thing.
Okay.
How slowly and surely, you know, as we emerging out of the pandemic. So what other innovation post-pandemic you expect to see that could, in response to refocus, like you talk so much about patient centricity and how we are include, you know, patient diversity through all the drug development. Can you elaborate on that and discuss? Yeah. Thank you.
So actually pre-COVID, I like to strategize and I like to think about where we're going in the future, right? And so actually, even before COVID, I could see that digital was going to really be a major force. And so in probably 2018, I think I appointed a medical digital lead. And we started doing two things. We started looking at the technology that was out there. So different platforms to connect, right? And then things like AI and machine learning and how we use that, all those sorts of things. So when actually, and we started experimenting. Now, I tell you, change management in this area is really tough. So we did a lot of work with our affiliates, with the people to try and get them to understand what the need for change was. So actually, in a way, COVID did us a little bit of a favor because, of course, we went overnight from very face-to-face engagement, especially in Asia, of course, you know, we pride ourselves on face-to-face, to actually digital engagements and using different forms. And so we had a lot of different platforms. One of the things we found was that the doctors in particular, the healthcare professionals, would say to us, oh, please don't make us use WebEx, or please don't make us use this platform. We use Zoom for everything else. Let's just use Zoom, you know. So we had to change to that. And you can imagine in particular, China actually adapted very quickly because they're actually at the forefront of technology. Japan was slower.
Interesting.
Particularly, you know, the more revered professors, the professors who were, you know, really the ones you wanted to engage with, because they weren't so tech savvy, but of course Japan's had to evolve. The interesting country was Korea, because they were the most resistant before we started, but they have amazing uptake. And so actually now they're all very engaged. So the result of that was two things. We had to train our staff, right? Because when you do meetings like this, for example, you actually, especially one-on-one, you have to plan a bit better. You have to have an agenda. You can't just present on a Zoom call the way you present in person. It doesn't really work. There are tips and techniques, and we probably all know them, you know, look at the camera, speak more slowly, that kind of thing. So we had to train our staff. And then the other thing that we started getting to the HoloLens. So what we had already started doing before COVID, we had started using hologram technology for our speakers. And we found that instead of somebody having to get on a plane for 14 hours, come to Asia, do a talk, and then go back again, we could actually hologram them in. And so it was literally like they were sitting on the stage, and you can either do it live or you can do it recorded. So that was, we'd already been experimenting with that. And it means it's not just one venue to one venue. You can do multiple venues. So on the education front, one of the things that we do a lot is we connect people in countries in Asia. For example, we do centers of excellence training. And again, previously it was people would come to the centers of excellence. You know, they'd spend a lot of time there, which is always good because it means they build partnerships and things. But during COVID, of course, we couldn't do that. So we found this HoloLens technology. And what it is, it's virtual reality. I don't know how many of you have, you know, played video games or played virtual reality games or that kind of thing. So it's that. But actually, then it uses hologram technology. So you put it on, it recognizes your fingers. And so you have what the video showed was somebody in London operating on a patient, and then somebody in Mumbai, and somebody in, I think, I can't remember the third place was, but it was basically three different places around the world using that technology to actually share the case notes, to discuss the patients like real time. And in fact, the technologies evolved. We're into HoloLens 2. So they have avatars. So actually you can have the avatar, which now looks like you, if you want it to, actually sitting in the operating theater. So as an example, on Saturday, I think, yeah, we're doing a meeting, which is a hybrid meeting, so we hope, where we're actually going to get some people together in Hong Kong, some physicians in Hong Kong. We have a physician in Japan, and we have a physician in Thailand, and they're going to be using this technology to share case studies around reducing plaque. It's imaging around reducing atherosclerosis in plaque, and the audience is Australia, Korea, Taiwan, Japan, Thailand, Singapore, and Hong Kong. So actually using this technology and using the digital outreach, you can actually reach a lot more people than we could before. You know, technically you could fly in all those people to a meeting and all the rest of it, but this way it's actually a lot more efficient. And we've done meetings not using HoloLens, but we've done other virtual meetings where we've had 2,000 people joining a training session. So this technology has really allowed us to really broaden. And like you, I'm passionate about education, and I think it's really, really important. And so that's one of the big pluses. It's allowed us to do that.
That's amazing, Victoria. Now, kind of, you know, seeing the video and you described, you know, how in reality you actually it's happening in your daily work. I'm even thinking about this year's our annual GBA. So if we're not able to fly in person, so we should try that one. So it looks like, you know, the choice of this going more virtual is not just a choice, it becomes a necessity, right? To so this is, you know, we could talk about hours, you know, just all those amazing innovation, improve the patient, you know, centricity, you know, development, drug development, the care. So maybe this is just the last one. I know that we have quite a lot of the audience has some of the questions. So, you know, you mentioned about APAC, you know, there is not just one country, there's a variety of, you know, diverse the region in the world. So where do you see specific opportunities they are rising in APAC? We all know, you know, how growth the clinical trial market there. And so where do you see our opportunities in APAC, you know, particularly in the innovation?
So I think there's a number of things there. I think, as you said, everyone knows, you know, it's 50% of the world's population. I have a slide with a circle and it shows 50% of the world's population is in Asia. And of course, there's a rising middle class. So more and more people are going to be demanding much better healthcare. And we're already seeing that, you know, with the rise of the biotech companies in China that are now going outside China. We recently had a drug registered in the US on only Chinese data, which was a first ever, which was pretty amazing. So I think there are a lot of opportunities. I mean, I love working in Asia because there is such an opportunity to partner and improve the healthcare systems. So I believe that's what we should be doing, is we should be part of the solution in trying to find solutions, because the population is so big. And so a lot of the governments are struggling to figure out how we're going to meet that patient need. On the innovation side, we see a lot of technology, particularly in China. So for example, my team in China has just done a big project using AI and using technology to actually really connect much better real time with their healthcare professional stakeholders. So they use WeChat, they have a platform on WeChat, they use that to connect with the healthcare providers, they get instant feedback about what the healthcare providers are, the publications they're looking at, so they can really tailor the offerings. So that's one big area. Another project that we're working on at the moment is using AI to really have a look at the insights. So traditionally, the way to get insights is we go out, we talk to our stakeholders, we have advisory boards, we collect all the insights. Now you can use AI to actually look at thousands of publications, look at all the congresses, and do it real time in a very short space of time. So, and then I think the third area that we have a lot of opportunity in Asia, you talk about patients and patient centricity. So traditionally in Asia, the patient voice is not so loud. Uh-huh. You know, people tend to listen to what their doctors say. I think that particularly after COVID, that we have a real opportunity to work with patient associations and help the patients and their caregivers, as importantly, really find their voice to actually say what they want, to actually make decisions around healthcare, educate them, that kind of thing. So I think those are some of the opportunities.
Great. Maybe just one last, you know, if you may just summarize in one sentence, what do you see today's medical affairs mission?
The mission for me, it's about partnering with our external stakeholders to improve patient outcomes and improve standards of care. That's really what we should be doing. You know, we can all, if we all work together and we make it a partnership, not just transactional, but we really make it a long-term partnership, then we can work together to improve patient outcomes and standards of care.
Thank you so much, Victoria. I have so many more questions, and I definitely will reach out for more discussion offline. But let me give it back to Bridget and Shelby. So we have some of the audience questions. So take it over.
Okay. Yeah. So we have a lot of questions coming through, and thank you so much for such an insightful discussion, Professor Elegant and Shuni. The first one I think is important because this person wanted to learn or clarify a few points on medical affairs, I think. So they say the world of medical affairs is expanding, you know, past drug development and commercialization. And their question is, end to end, how is medical affairs different than clin-ops?
Oh, completely different. So clinical ops, so it's always confusing, and different companies, to be honest, use different language, but clinical operations generally means the people who are responsible for the operational aspects of the clinical trial. So it tends to be the people who go out to the sites, the clinical research associates, the project managers, that kind of thing. They will work with the clinical development people if their development protocols, for example, They're the ones who will develop the protocols and develop the science. Medical affairs, as I said, the focus for medical affairs is really about the external engagements and bringing the insights in. So medical affairs generally are the people who will provide the insights to make sure that those protocols, those scientific protocols, when we do drug development, and then further through the life cycle, as you talked about commercialization, that we get the insights to make sure that we're doing the right strategies, essentially. So operations, I'm just trying to think of an analogy. The operations people are like the people who actually conduct the trials. Medical affairs sort of sits alongside a lot of the other functions. So we all work very closely together. For example, in managing the sites for the clinical trials, medical will work because they have often really good relationships with the investigators, for example. So the operations people will be the ones who get the trials done, and medical will work with them to make sure we choose the right sites, to engage with the investigators, that kind of thing.
That's great. Thank you. So we actually had another question come in just now from our audience. So thank you for sending in your questions. So this one is, assuming that access to healthcare is key, how would the initiatives developed during the pandemic be of help in the future? So how would the role of intercultural communication in providing this access be affected?
Absolutely critical. Actually, the whole issue of access is so important. As we all know, there's no point developing a wonderful medicine if no one will pay for it, frankly. So you have to actually think about the access aspects right at the beginning of when you're doing your drug development to make sure that the clinical difference that you're going to make really is breakthrough. And then you actually need to be doing those partnerships, as we talked about before, with not just our healthcare professionals, but our payers and the government and those people, to actually make sure that drug will actually get to the patients that need it most. I think what COVID has done again is it's probably raised the importance of actually having the right medicines even further, but it's also enabled us to think more about accelerating the drug development and shortening the timelines. So I think we'll see a lot more around things like adaptive trial design or having regulatory approvals that are then approved, but then dependent on trials that will confirm, you know, you'll do a confirmatory trial, that kind of thing, so as to make sure that we get access to the medicines more quickly. But medical plays a very, very important part in terms of access and putting the evidence together. So access is not just about price, but it's about, you know, the clinical effect. And so the medical teams are the ones who are best placed to actually put those arguments in place, if you like, about the clinical effect and why it's so important, the fact that it's breakthrough, that kind of thing. So most of the industry is discussing this a lot and thinking about how to really best leverage medical and their expertise to make sure that we get the access that the patients need.
Thank you so much. The next question is on the importance of patient centricity and patient diversity. How are these two themes reflected in drug or clinical trial development?
It's a great question. So, and it has two different answers. So I might talk about the diversity first. Actually, last year, with everything that happened in the US and Black Lives Matter and all the things that have been happening in the US, it's really called attention to the fact that in our clinical trials, actually, the diversity has not been, particularly in the US I'm talking about, has not been perhaps as it should be. And so there's huge initiatives underway. There's a cross-industry forum that is looking at this to make sure that we have targets to actually put in diverse ethnicities in particular. And so that's ongoing. The other area, at least for me, which is sort of close to my heart, is to make sure that we have enough Asian patients in our trials. So that's another area. And in particular, And actually, one of our thought leaders in Singapore published a paper about 3 years ago about the lack of Asian women in clinical trials, actually. So we're all looking at what we can do to make sure that we actually increase that diversity in clinical trials, because, you know, different people react differently to drugs. We know that women sometimes react differently as well. If they're not in the clinical trials, then we just have to wait till after the drug's approved. So it's really important to make sure that we have those in. So that's one piece about the diversity. The patient centricity is really interesting, actually. So, and I think, as we were talking about earlier, patients, the voice of the patient has, we need to really help to find a way to amplify that. Healthcare systems are not built for patients. I don't, you know, you've all probably been a patient at some time. It sucks. Honestly, being a patient is just horrible. You know, you have no control. You're just at the mercy of the system. You have to wait for hours. People come and tell you what to do. You, if you're in hospital, they, you know, all that sort of stuff. What we've discovered is that actually, if you include the patient voice and you work with patient associations and you make sure that you talk to them as you're doing your clinical trial, they can actually look at the clinical trial and tell you if it's going to work or not, what you need to put in, what you don't need to put in. So that's one piece. And we've, it's been shown that if you do that, you can get recruitment much faster. Another area that's becoming much, much more important is patient-reported outcomes. So we've always done, well, not always, but we've done, we do quality of life in all sorts of other areas, but patient-reported outcomes are really now increasingly becoming more and more important, particularly in chronic diseases. And then the other area that's becoming really important is about patients as authors and making sure that we have opportunities for patients to author publications. And again, if we have clinical trial results, that we have clinical trial summaries that are in plain language. We did that for consent forms and things years ago. But now increasingly what we're doing is clinical trial summaries in plain language so the patients can understand it. Because, you know, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine the other day about the language around law, for example, or around finance. It's sort of like a secret society, and medicine's the same, but it doesn't need to be. You know, you just have to write it in language so that people understand. So increasingly, what we really want to do is to make sure that the patients have that voice, particularly in Asia, where, you know, traditionally it hasn't been so loud, and it's getting better. We're putting some things in place to do that.
That's fantastic. That's amazing. Just hearing about how to put the patient in the center of the whole drug development. That's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like on both sides, it's beneficial to have, you know, the patient voice incorporated into the clinical trial. So we just have time for one more question. I know we're running a little bit over. So our final audience question is, what is the driving force behind the increasing number of clinical trials being conducted in Asia?
Oh, well, so once upon a time, so I've been working in Asia for a while. Once upon a time, everybody was frightened about coming to Asia because they were worried about the languages. They were worried that there were no clinical trial centers that had the capabilities to do the clinical trials to the standards that, for example, FDA wanted. There was also the issue, particularly in China, of course, of IP and worries about IP, those kinds of things. But increasingly now, people have realized that many of the trial centers have investigators who've all trained overseas and then come back. So they're really, really experienced. There are a lot of patients in Asia to that point. So, you know, sometimes you get patient populations in other places. You need to come to Asia to actually get the numbers in the trial that you actually need. Those are some of the things. It used to be that it was cheaper to do the clinical trials in Asia, not so much anymore. That's really not a big factor. And then I think the centers here also have, at least, again, I haven't worked in Europe for a while, but certainly we're looking at things like the data banks here. Some of the hospitals have amazing databases full of patients. I went out to one of the hospitals in Hong Kong yesterday, and they were showing me their health authority patient data system. They have 20 years worth of patient data from the Hong Kong, from all the 7 million patients in Hong Kong that have gone through the health authority, all in a database, all with the imaging, and that's replicated, say, in Korea, all sorts of places like that. So it also makes it easier to work with academics to actually access those data to answer research questions, apart from just the, you know, prospective clinical trials. So increasingly, you will have heard people talk about real world data. And so that's really one of the areas that's growing. And in Asia, we have great sources of those data. So those are several reasons.
Oh, that's super interesting. And it makes sense when you think about it, of course. So unfortunately, that is all the time for the questions that we have for today. So on behalf of CSoft Health Sciences, we really want to thank you, Victoria and Shuni, for a fascinating and insightful discussion, as well as to all of our audience members who submitted questions ahead of time about the current state of global medical affairs and advancing global health. If you love this podcast episode and you want to catch up on previous episodes, you can find any of them on our website and on any major podcast platform as well. Just search CSoft's Coffee and Conversations. Additionally, we invite you to come join us, CSoft Health Sciences, at DIA Global's annual meeting held from June 27th to July 1st. So that's Monday through Thursday next week. We would love to see you there and visit us at our booth.
Thank you so much. Really, it's always such a pleasure.
Thank you.
To talk with you, and Bridget and Shelby. Thank you so much. I feel very honored to be on the Coffee and Conversation.
Thank you so much. Look forward to connecting again. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
For more information on CSoft's language translation services, visit csoftintl.com.